This is the Talks with Teachers podcast. I'm your host, Brian Stabnik, episode number 78. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Talks with Teachers podcast. I'm your host, Brian Stabnik, a high school English teacher, husband, father on Long Island. And I believe every teacher has a story worth sharing. And that's what this podcast is about. I interview master teachers, they share their story, and they offer practical tips, all because I want you to be better in the classroom. My guest this week is Sarah Donovan. She's a middle school English teacher in Illinois, but she's also the creator of Ethical ELA. Before we get to my interview with Sarah, just want to let you know this is that time of year when teachers are searching for new ideas. Well, we've got them in the Best Lesson Series literature. In the book, 15 Master Teachers Share Their Best Literature Lesson, it's got tons of great ideas that you can incorporate into your classroom. To get a free sample, all you have to do is go to bestlessonseries.com. And now, finally, here's my interview with Sarah, and I hope you have a great week in your classroom. Talk to you soon. So I feel every teacher has a story, and I'd love to hear your story as a teacher, where you started, where you are now, and everything in between.
I'm a social worker for about 7 years, and it was really hard work, but I found after a few years of doing it that it was quite a privilege for me to be listening to stories of people's lives in a time when they were most vulnerable, and in a time where I had a lot of power, being on one side of the bulletproof glass when they were on the other side, and I was in power to ask their stories, and for the most part, everyone was really forthcoming and had a lot to say. Yeah, and so after doing that for about 7 years, I had a really hard time separating the stories that I heard from the life that I was going home to at the end of the day, and it was really a struggle for me to stay hopeful about things, and that was the time where I decided I wanted to pursue changing careers, and I started a master's in education in English, where I thought that would be a great place to sit alongside students as they told their stories and to read stories of the world together. And that's really what brought me to English. It wasn't so much of love of literature or a favorite book, but it was about the stories that inform our lives.
And what did you take with you from your time as a social worker that, I guess, informed your practice as an English teacher?
Well, it's really great how social work training teaches you to be a really good listener. And, you know, there's a class in dynamics of conversation and active listening. And they teach you how to ask questions, how to listen, how to use eye contact, how to clarify what you heard. And those are just some of the basic things about communication that before I took a class about counseling skills, it didn't occur to me what a poor listener I was. And I really brought that into the classroom and made that a foundation in the first, you know, few weeks of being with students to talk about how we look each other in the eye when we listen and how we show that we're following someone just with some body language and how it is important to clarify what you heard and ask a follow-up question. And then also to be conscious of the fact that a lot of times when we listen to someone else, we're thinking about the next question or what we want to say, our own personal connection to what they're saying. So instead of listening and responding and sort of being with the other person's story, we're waiting to tell our own story. And so I became really conscious of that when I was a social worker and I tried to bring it into the classroom. The truth is I'm not always successful. Sometimes I can't wait to talk because I want to share my connection. But it's a really important lesson, I think, to bring into the classroom with your students. And I think a lot of teachers really do that well.
I learned that as a podcaster. My first few interviews that I recorded, I was always thinking about what would be my next question to ask and how I would follow up just to keep the conversation going. And I realized in doing that, I wasn't fully committed to listening with my complete attention. And so just like you said, I learned that ability to just sit back and just soak it in and be an active listener rather than a distracted one.
Yeah, true. And do I understand correctly that you have some journalism background?
Yeah, I was a journalism major, and my first 2 years before teaching, I covered high school sports and college football as well.
Yeah, I feel like there's so much to learn from journalism. I wasn't for journalism, but I do try to include some sort of journalism or interviewing techniques in the classroom in our writing class, because I feel like there's so much to be learned from that profession, and even to encourage kids to imagine what that might be like to be a journalist and to be responsible for other people's stories. So I think even just like thinking about the different professions where we need reading and writing skills, bringing those into the classroom is also really helpful. So a social worker, a journalist, we're about listening to people's stories and trying to understand lives a little bit better.
And what was part of your learning curve as a new teacher? Because I feel even the best people that have the highest ambitions about coming into the classroom and what they're going to do, there's always this adjustment to what you expect to happen and what actually happens. So what was part of your learning curve?
Oh, gosh. It was really frightening. You know, my first day at, you know, the professional development, usually there's 2 or 3 days of professional development or institute days before school starts. And it was 2004, my first job as a middle school teacher, the first time coming into work without having to go through a metal detector. And yeah, it's great. And I was thrilled to just, you know, be in a cafeteria with teachers sitting around and listening to people talk about what they read over the summer and what they were hoping to do for the new school year. And then we were sort of moved into our departments, and we went into the department chair's classroom, and she took out all these rosters and highlighters and told us that these were our students, and our job was to highlight bubble kids. And I, you know, was looking around the room and thinking, okay, I don't want to look like I don't know what I'm doing. So I took out the highlighter, and I was kind of looking at my colleagues to see what they were doing. And I'm like, I don't know what a bubble kid is. I don't know what I'm supposed to be highlighting. And so I did end up asking the department chair, and she said the bubble kids were the kids who, you know, did not meet on the Illinois State exam the prior year. They were students that were going to be in my classroom. I needed to identify them and target them to see if I could get them to meet on the standards the next year, because they were on the bubble. They were really close to meeting on the next year's state exam. So this was my first day of school. I'm looking forward to meeting my students and hearing their stories, but instead I'm targeting them to meet the test that was going to come up in March. So that was a really interesting initiation into what it meant to be in the institution of a school. You know, I had tough lessons when I had to be in the institution of prison. And I hate to compare school and prison, but they're both institutions, and they both have these systems in place that people don't really know about until you're inside the system and trying to navigate it. So my first couple years were really tough trying to navigate all the rules and the values that were sort of pressing in on what I had hoped to do in the classroom. And I wasn't alone. The other teachers felt the same way. But there was this pressure to meet on these state exams. And this was where AYP was just sort of rolling out, or No Child Left Behind Act. So my career began at the beginning of No Child Left Behind. And here I am, you know, 12 years later when Common Core is being started. So been quite a journey for me.
And what was the thing that helped you grow from a beginning teacher to an experienced and successful teacher? Was it a specific book that you read that spoke to you? Was it another teacher in your building? Was it just a methodology in terms of your instruction? Did you do like project-based learning? Like, what was the thing that you think really was a tipping point for you in your career?
Oh, Brian, it is really easy for me to answer this question. The tipping point came the following year, when I was in the department chair's classroom, during the time that we were doing our professional development, 2 days before we were going to meet the students. And there was a mandate from the state of Illinois that they had just signed into law. Governor Blagojevich, of all people, signed this into law. And he said that in light of the recent unrest in the Sudan and Colin Powell's naming of what was happening in the Sudan at that time as genocide, that the Senate, the Illinois Senate, wanted to pass a law that would include a unit of instruction on genocide. And this was an amendment to a mandate in the school code from 1999, I believe, or requiring a unit of instruction on the Holocaust. So within the first day of the school year, within the first couple of days before the school year began, I was told not about bubbling and or highlighting bubble kits. I was told that I would have to teach a unit on genocide. So this mandate to teach a unit on genocide came at the beginning of my second year of teaching, and neither I nor the other teachers in the department were familiar with genocide instruction or even what genocide was, and I really felt horrible and ignorant. The fact that I didn't know very much about what was going on in Sudan at the time, that I was unfamiliar with that there even was a genocide in Armenia and Bosnia and Rwanda and Cambodia, nor could I find all those places on the map. So while the year before I didn't know what a bubble kid was and I was unsure how to highlight my roster, I was faced with a decidedly different sort of discomfort my second year teaching with this genocide mandate. And it really seemed to me like there were these two really different messages that I was getting about what we were supposed to be doing in schools. You know, on one hand, we were supposed to be targeting students and building up their skills and collecting data so that we could help them pass the state exam so no child is left behind. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, we're supposed to be talking about these unimaginable things that are happening in our world that continue to happen in our world, even though, you know, decades ago, people pledged never again would there be another Holocaust. And so there hasn't been another Holocaust. They're all quite different. But again and again, these sort of massacres are happening around the world because of politics and economics and our lack of recognizing the humanity across the world. So as a English teacher, you know, I was sort of stuck with, I didn't know which direction to go. I couldn't teach data-centered, research-based methods while talking about what was happening in Sudan in a way. I wanted to hear stories. I wanted to talk about why stories are important and how to humanize what was happening. That seems so unfamiliar to me, and of course it would be to the students as well. And so this was really a turning point for me, Brian, where I was like, I have to kind of go where my heart is, and I have to find ways of pushing back or integrating or making sense of the teacher I imagined I would be and within the system that I was starting to figure out.
And how did that happen?
Well, I started reading. I just took it upon myself to find books about the different genocides and to start developing some curriculum and to start trying it out and sharing that with teachers. And there was a few teachers who were really resistant to taking on this curriculum, in part because they thought it should be in the history department. And there were a few English teachers who felt like, yeah, this was important and how can we do this well in a really thoughtful, ethical way. And yes, there are ethical questions with how do you read literature that represents humanity in its darkest light, without light, I guess it's not, we're trying to illuminate the horrible things that are happening in the world, but also illuminate humanity's resilience at the same time. So we started having really interesting conversations with teachers. And as a new teacher, this sort of curriculum and this mandate ended up bridging some gaps for me with the other teachers. So as a new teacher coming in, I think maybe other new teachers can relate. You feel like you're a bit of an outsider. And some teachers would even say, some veteran teachers might even tell you to keep your mouth shut for a few years until you've sort of earned your keep at the school. But this genocide curriculum and all of our hope to do right by it kind of brought us together where we had these conversations. And so one teacher in particular who became a mentor of mine, and she had probably 25 years of teaching over me, came alongside me, and we chose books and tried them out in our classrooms and talked about it. And we talked about how we had kind of set aside some of the test prep stuff and read these stories with the students and you know, sometimes even cried in class trying to make sense of the things that we were reading. And that just sort of led us into some really great conversations about the conflict that we were feeling about test prep and test scores and the sort of curriculum and the sort of teacher we wanted to be. So that really helped me kind of make this shift into my second year. And then that was just sort of my mission, was just trying to find a balance between those two things every year and continue to talk to teachers about how they were doing it as well.
And you mentioned that a story being the heart of your class and that you have students engage in conversations about the stories that they're reading. That's a struggle for a lot of teachers, and not just English teachers, is to get classroom participation. How do you draw kids into the story and make them want to open their voice, open their mind, and actually speak their thoughts to other people in the classroom?
You're right. It is a really difficult thing to get students to tell their stories and to use their voices out loud, because it means you have to be vulnerable and open yourself up to the potential of someone hurting you or not being a good listener. And in middle school, I teach seventh and eighth grade. That is a really difficult time. Even for me, I share some of my stories with the classroom, and I'm like a little girl, scared that they're going to laugh at my story or say something that might hurt my feelings, which has happened. And I just do my best to be honest about how it feels to tell stories. So we do a story exchange to kind of start this classroom culture of sharing stories and being vulnerable and being a good listener. And I try to frame it around this idea of bearing witness and what a privilege it is to bear witness to each other's lives. And that once you hear someone's story, you become a witness to their life, and you kind of are charged with this responsibility to carry their story with you. So like once you hear a story, whether it's a really unimaginable story about genocide, or if it's a story about your classmate, about their favorite hiding place when they were little, that story becomes a part of your own because you now have it and you carry it. And it sort of mixes with your own stories and your own brain. And when you, especially when a story is told really well, that imagery becomes part of you as well. So we do a story exchange maybe every couple weeks throughout the school year, where I give a few topics of stories, and students take a few minutes to kind of remember the story or that, and I'll just use the example of a favorite hiding place that you might have had. And instead of you writing your story of your favorite hiding place, my job is to ask you for your story. And you tell me your story. And I do my best to listen and nod and ask follow-up questions. And when you're done telling me your story, I go away and I write your story. And then when I'm done writing your story, I read it back to you. And I ask you if I did a good job representing your story, and if there's anywhere that I misrepresented it or missed a detail, or if you feel like it resonates with the memory that you had, and you give me feedback from my story. And then I ask you for permission to share your story. I'm asking you for consent. And you can choose or not choose if you want to give me consent to share your story with someone else. And then later in the week, we have an opportunity to do a sharing. We usually have Friday celebrations with read alouds, where students share a piece, and then afterwards we get some celebrations. And so if someone has given consent to share their story, then that story is read aloud in class on that Friday, and then there's sort of celebrations for that story. And so this works for a few reasons. Number one, it's a story exchange. So after you share your story with me, I share one with you, and we go through the same process. And number two, I'm asking for consent to share your story. And, you know, on social media, a lot of people kind of share a picture without giving consent, without getting consent from the other person. Or there's a lot of kind of gossip going on at school. And we don't always think about that it would be beneficial if you got someone's consent before you share what they said to you. So this idea of being vulnerable, of being a listener, of checking in to make sure that what you heard is right or represents their experience in a fair way, and then asking consent to share the story. And then if you don't get consent, then it sort of just becomes yours, and there's some responsibility for holding that story.
So tell me a little bit about the story that you're telling online with your blog, Ethical ELA. What story is it that you're hoping to tell?
Well, I'm hoping to sort of shift the conversations and the stories that we tell in our classroom from stories about best practice and research-based lessons and standards-based instruction and data-driven ideas and systems and things like that. I'd like to sort of shift the conversation to conversations about humanity and conversations about the lives of the teachers and of the students, their parents, and even a grandparent was on the blog the other day, and about how reading and writing contributes to our lives and how it helps us make sense of humanity. And then to bring up the conversation about what we should be doing in our classroom for the human beings with whom we're entrusted. You know, I like to think about, what if little Eddie's father or mother were in the back of the classroom? How would they feel about the way that I teach and the kind of things that we're doing in our classroom? And I don't think we have been talking enough about the responsibility we have for raising human beings who are going to go out into the world and hopefully imagine what the world ought to look like instead of just kind of participating in the world that's already out there.
And why is that so important right now? Because there are plenty of people out there that believe that we need to see results, and the results are best shown in the numbers. By incorporating a more ethical approach to how we teach, what benefit does that bring about?
I think it shifts to the qualitative data instead of the quantitative data, or at least it's going to ask for put some qualitative data alongside the quantitative. So instead of looking at the test board to decide what class a student is going to go into, that there maybe is some extra time or energy looking at their portfolio of writing, maybe having conversations with students about what they're learning and adding that to the data. I know it's really hard to do with the number of students that we're talking about and the size of school and the size of the institution is growing, but I think it's worth heading in that direction.
And you mentioned before about students feeling vulnerable to tell their story. What made it appealing to you to hop online and tell your story?
Because I'm asking other people to do it. You know, if I, one of the difficult things has been for me in my own classroom is to be ethical in what I'm asking to do. If I'm asking students to tell me their story, I feel like I have to tell them mine. And I wrote a blog a couple days or like last week about oversharing. And I included a piece that I wrote in my classroom last year about my father, about a dream that I had about my father. And I posted it, and then I also shared it with my siblings. I have 7 sisters and 3 brothers. And I shared it with the ones who would read. And a few of them emailed me back and said that they thought, indeed, I was oversharing. And others thought, thank you for the story, because they didn't feel comfortable saying it, but I said it in a way that helped them understand our father a little bit better. And when I told that story to my students, they said to me, I didn't realize that you were a person. And it really sounds like they didn't realize that at one time I was a little girl or that I have those stories to share. And so I share them really comfortably now in my classroom with students, but I don't share them as well with my friends or my family. And if I'm going to ask other teachers to tell their story, if I'm going to ask parents to tell their story, I feel like it's important for me to get out there and tell my story.
And I've encouraged other teachers to blog as well. And so what is it about blogging that's improved your practice? Because I think that's one of the ultimate goals here is you're not just doing it for the narcissistic attention. You're actually doing it to become a better teacher. How has it made you a better teacher?
Yeah, you know what makes me really uncomfortable, Brian? The narcissistic question is important to mention. I'm glad that you say that because I think some teachers hesitate to write their stories because they feel like they don't want to be judged or they don't want people to think, oh, she's all that, she knows everything. You know, you're taking a risk by talking about something that worked for you, and some teachers go the other way and talk about things that didn't work. for them. Maybe they're a little bit more self-deprecating, and that seems a little bit more comfortable for blogging. I think that we want the teachers to get out there and to say, talk about their experiences, because it will teach them to be more reflective. I think it's another way of being accountable other than the data. I think it's being accountable by saying, these are the choices that I made, and this was sort of the outcome. And gosh, did I do what was good for the student? Was it right? Is this what we ought to be doing in the classroom? I think that's a helpful approach to growth. And I think that's a pretty valid assessment of the kind of things that are happening in the classroom without adding numbers to it.
And finally, if people want to get a sense of ethical ELA, what's the one post that you would point them to start with, to really understand your perspective, your voice, and your mission?
Yeah, the first post that I made about my students, it's a pretty good summary of the first year or so of my teaching. I talk about kind of the story that I have here that I told you today about my first year, and I kind of tell the story of one girl who started her education as a kindergartner at the same year that I started my education as a teacher. And I think that that's a good place to start, my first post. And I also think the oversharing post is a really good one too, because the oversharing is a good example of the kind of writing that I think we can do in our classroom. I think it's okay to ask questions. And I have another post that I just wrote last week about democracy and what eighth graders think about what reading and writing is supposed to be. In some ways, that post was a little horrifying to me at first, because when I asked my students to say, I just did like a really informal survey, and I asked them what reading means to them, what writing means to them, and what a good writer is. And when students said to me, a good writer is one who has perfect spelling or good grammar, and a good reader is someone who gets high scores on comprehension and vocabulary, I was sort of mortified to think that the students are going out into the world thinking that's what writing is and that's what reading is. And I think that we're at a point now with this new kind of common core and people trying to figure out what that can look like. I think we're at a good point where we can start having a shift in the culture of what happens in our classroom. So that democracy in ELA and what eighth graders think about it, I think that's a really good point. Maybe that's where I would start.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Talks with Teachers podcast. Sarah's looking for guest bloggers on her site, Ethical ELA, so go check it out. It's really easy to find, ethicalela.com. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Talks with Teachers podcast, and I hope you have a great week in your classroom.